This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The United States Senate is about to go to the mattresses. Workers have already moved rollaway cots into a Senate conference room in preparation for what could be an all-night debate on judicial nominees and the power of the filibuster. Arguments got underway earlier today. The nomination at issue is that of Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen to the federal bench. Here are the party leaders, Republican Bill Frist of Tennessee, then Democrat Harry Reid of Nevada.
We have spent more floor time on Priscilla Owen than on all the sitting Supreme Court justices combined. Yes, Justice Owen has not received one single up or down vote on the Senate floor. Not one.
Patricia Owen has had numerous votes. She's had three that I'm aware of on this Senate floor, and those votes dealt with whether or not we should stop debating her. The votes three times have said no.
The way it looks now, Majority Leader Frist will call for a vote on the Owens nomination as soon as tomorrow. That could trigger the so-called nuclear option, a political meltdown that threatens to bring the business of the Senate to a crawl. Over the weekend, moderates on both sides of the aisle, the so-called Group of 12, continued discussions on a possible compromise. More on that in just a minute. Later in the program, Will Eisner's graphic history, The Plot, the secret story of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. But first, the filibuster fight. The story is high-stakes drama here in Washington, but recent opinion polls show most people outside the Beltway find it a snooze. So what about you? If you have questions about what's happening, if you think this is a big deal or a dud, give us a call and tell us why. Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We go first to Capitol Hill and to Senator Bill Nelson, a Democrat from Nebraska. He's been involved in negotiations in efforts to reach a compromise. Senator, good to have you on the program.
Well, one correction. It's Ben Nelson, not Bill. I don't want Bill upset with me.
I do apologize
for
that.
It's okay.
Where do things stand right now in the effort to find a compromise?
Well, we continue to work with one another. There are a lot of discussions going back and forth, telephone calls, talking about language in a proposed agreement. As time comes to the end here, obviously we're all looking for a solution and an agreement, and I think if we're able to achieve it, we'll be able to achieve it tonight.
And how would a proposed compromise work?
Well, a compromise would do at least two things. One is it would assure, in most cases of judicial nominees, an up or down vote. It would not bind my colleagues on the Democratic side or Republican side to vote for cloture against certain nominees. But it would, for the most part, it would stop the filibustering of most judicial nominations. On the second side, it would also suspend any effort by the Republicans to move toward the nuclear option. In other words, it would resolve the impasse and let us move forward on judicial nominees, but at the same time begin the important work that we must pick up on, and that's the energy bill and a whole host of other similar items.
So, as I understand it, the descriptions in the papers this morning, at least five of the seven most controversial nominees would be guaranteed a vote on the floor. At the same time, Democrats would preserve the option, in some cases, of filibuster.
That's correct. It would reserve the right and the option of filibustering, but wouldn't guarantee that the filibuster would be used even in those cases, but it would make it clear that if each senator felt in his or her opinion that a particular nominee involved exceptional circumstances, extraordinary is the word that's used, then they could vote against that. They could vote for the filibuster or, in effect, against cloture.
What's holding things up?
Well, you know, when you get 12 senators in a room, there are 14 opinions, at least, maybe more. The key is that we're continuing to look at language to make sure that everybody is comfortable with the draft and redrafting of language. The very encouraging thing about this process is that we've all learned to work together. There are a whole host of us that have not worked together before this closely. And when you're looking to make things happen and to get something done, you really begin to understand and develop mutual trust with one another. And that's been a very important part of this process.
well, listening to the rhetoric on this issue, trust is an elusive concept in Washington these days.
Well, it is it's a very rare one. But among these 12 or 13 individuals, I think we've gotten to where we trust one another very much. And we've also tried not to undercut the leaders on either caucus. We want to make sure that we're working with them as much as we can. But we also know that at the end of the time frame, we don't want to see judges not get up or down votes wherever we possibly can. And at the same time, we don't want to see this meltdown that would come most likely from a nuclear option.
Mm-hmm. Are there going to be any winners on this issue, either way this happens?
Well, I think the winners are the American people getting up or down votes on most of the judges, but at the same time recognizing that the minority rights that are protected by the filibuster are retained as well. So I think we avoid the runaway situation that you can have with a simple majority, and we preserve for the future the right to object through the use of a filibuster wherever it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Both sides in the compromise, obviously compromise means giving something up. On the Republican side, Senator Frist said he wants up or down votes on all of the nominees. President Bush said the same thing today. That's hard to fudge.
Well, you know, the only way they can do that, I guess, is to do away with the nuclear option, or to, through the nuclear option, do away with the filibuster. Well, they don't have enough votes on their side if we come to this agreement. So that's clearly what this is about.
Senator Nelson, good luck to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska, spoke with us from his office on Capitol Hill. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Neil.
Do Senator Nelson and his colleagues have a chance of avoiding the nuclear option by this compromise?
It does not appear that they do. Certainly there is a chance in the sense that if it were all to fall the way that they have described, and the senator did a nice job of describing how that would be done, it is not apparent at this point that they have hit upon a language formulation that all 12 or 13, as the senator said, could all subscribe to. That's going to be extremely difficult to do because, for example, if you were to say, under extraordinary circumstances, individual senators might still use the filibuster, Well, that essentially preserves the right of filibuster, and that is exactly what this whole argument is about. The president and Senate Majority Leader have said the filibuster should not be an absolute right for any given senator or for either party in the event of a judicial nomination. And whether you believe that that could be limited to judicial nominations or not, that's what they claim. They say they are only interested in shutting down judicial nomination filibusters. And I don't see how you make a compromise by which that principle and the other principle, the up or down vote for absolutely every nominee, can be honored. I just don't see how they sort that out, unless you go ahead and characterize this as a rebellion against the leadership, which, of course, Senator Ben Nelson did not want to do. He did not want to say, he said, we're working to help the leaders. We're not trying to undercut the leaders. But it's impossible to see how you would resolve this matter without essentially taking it out of their hands and saying, no, we're going to deny you the votes in either direction. We're going to keep either party from being the majority in this body. And we're going to set up a third, if you will, moderate party in the center that denies its votes to either side.
And which trusts, because this is all based on trust, and trusts the other guys in that moderate party to hang with their we also talked about the rhetorical corner that the majority leader, Senator Frist, is in. Harry Reid of Nevada, the minority leader, is also in a corner, the opposite one.
Correspondingly, he has committed himself to preserve the right of the filibuster for all of these nominees and not to essentially throw any of the Democrats' captives over the side. In the end, of course, any intransigent position can just be backed away from if the people who have taken that position have the will to do so, have the mind to do so. But what I see here, and the reason why I think the chance of a deal or a compromise is remote, what I see here is a drive to see whether or not this can be accomplished by fiat, that the White House has brought to bear all its guns, and it wants to achieve the right to approve a judicial nomination with 50 votes plus the tie-breaking vote of Vice President Dick Cheney, and that this is their strategy for a Supreme Court nominee.
is this issue resonating where you live? Call and tell us what people are saying in your town about the issue of the filibuster fight in the United States Senate, if they're saying anything at all. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn at npr.org. And let's begin with Mike, and Mike's calling us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I had a question, more or less. Are the Republicans kind of playing roulette here? What if in a couple of years the Democrats take over? Can these rules be changed back? Will the Republicans try to go back the opposite direction once the Democrats are in control, and then they have Democratic, more liberal judges who are being nominated for the bench?
Mm-hmm. Is what, sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander?
Yeah.
Ron?
An excellent question, and it's very much on the minds of some of the Republican senators who are urging caution in this regard. But let's consider who's driving this train. The President of the United States will be the president for as long as he's the president. He's not worried about what comes after, particularly. Number two, the Vice President, same situation. Senator Bill Frist, who normally might be very concerned about 2006 and possible loss of control, is leaving the Senate in 2006. He's not running for re-election. He's going to go, and he's going to run for president. So his concern is through 2006, as far as the Senate rules are concerned. The other thing to observe is that pretty much across the board, the Republicans do not seem terribly concerned about losing the majority in the Senate. They feel quite confident they will hold it in 2006, 2008, and beyond. Now, of course, no one can guarantee it forever, but they're willing to take that risk in order to have the ability to proceed now without this limitation.
So, Mike, are people talking about this in St. Louis?
People, it's being debated, at least amongst the circle of people that I deal with. The concern is whether or not why change the rules now, mm-hmm. after so many years of, you know, the system working the way that it is, why all of a sudden change the rules? And I was watching Fox News Network one day, and I believe it was Brit Hume brought up the point that during the 50s and 60s, when they were debating civil rights for African Americans, you know, a lot of things were held up because of filibuster.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much. We'll have more on the filibuster fight after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If Senate moderates can't drag their particular parties into a compromise, a showdown over judicial nominees looks inevitable. If it all goes according to the script, first Republicans will revoke Democrats' ability to filibuster judicial nominees. Then, in retaliation, Democrats will begin a threatened slowdown of Senate business. All of that could begin as soon as tomorrow. What issues that might affect and how the public will respond are our questions today. You're invited to join us. Of course, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn at npr.org. Our guest is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. And Ron, just before the break, a caller from St. Louis, I think also named Ron, was asking about the use of the filibuster back in the 1960s to block civil rights legislation. Would this affect that at all?
Not technically, because we're only talking here about eliminating the filibuster for judicial nominees and not on legislation. So legislation would still be subject to the 60-vote rule to cut off debate. However, it has been argued that once you have eliminated the filibuster for judicial nominees, it's not a very long step to eliminating it for other kinds of nominees, such as John Bolton's nomination to be United Nations ambassador. That could be perhaps another case where the precedent that Mr. Cheney is invoking in this case could be invoked again, and they could say, well, you can't filibuster any kind of an executive nomination. He deserves an up or down vote. Then, of course, the argument becomes, why only for people? Why not legislation? Why shouldn't the Senate be ruled by a simple majority? That's the way the House operates, and that opens up the final layers of Pandora's box in this particular case, and people would be arguing that the filibuster really had no place in a democracy. Certainly the filibuster gained a very bad reputation in the 50s and 60s when it was used against civil rights legislation repeatedly, and it took months and months to break the filibuster in 1964 and bring about passage of the Civil Rights Act. Since that time, the number of votes needed to break a filibuster has been reduced from 67 down to 60, and that was largely because of the civil rights abuse of the filibuster, if you want to call it that. And Republicans may maintain today that this is another abuse of the filibuster, that it was really the Democrats who started this fight because they started applying filibusters to numerous judicial candidates, 10 in the last presidential term. Previous to that, there was a filibuster of Supreme Court nomination back in 1968 that ended when the candidate withdrew. There have been other instances of judges being blocked when nominated, but that's taken place by and large in committee or even before they got to committee. So it is unusual to see this tactic being applied to a candidate who's made it all the way to the Senate floor.
This is obviously big news inside the Washington Beltway. Joining us now to help us figure out how people around the country feel about this, joining us is Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Neil.
You conducted a survey on this issue with 1,500 Americans 2 weeks ago. What did you find?
Well, we found that the public wasn't paying close attention. Only 30% or a third were paying any attention to this filibuster fight, and 14% paying very close attention. Those are low numbers, even by Washington standards. But this is not going unrecognized. I mean, the public sees a big argument. They're not paying attention to the details. We had 64% saying that Congress's people on the Hill are bickering more than usual. That's a very high number. We haven't been in that region since October of 95, when 72% thought that, when the government was all but shut down or was shut down. So the public is noticing. And poll ratings for Congress are falling, both in our poll and in other polls. The Wall Street Journal put out a poll last week, had 33% approving of Congress. That's 51% disapproving. At the beginning of 04, those numbers were 46-41%. So this is a big decline. And we also even see declining percentages of people saying their member of Congress deserves reelection. Now, generally, the public is down on Congress but likes their own members. But the Wall Street Journal poll found only 42% saying their member deserves reelection, 45% saying no, compared to a 49-34 split back in 04, when, of course, most of them were reelected.
Yeah.
So while the public is not tracking, to make this simple, while the public is not tracking the ins and outs of this argument, they realize that these people are involved in a big fight up here and not much is getting done, and they're unhappy.
Of that 30% who is paying attention, how do they break down, or is that significant?
Well, I think it is, because it might be it might portend what would happen as more people pay attention. And among that group, we find a 54-36% majority opposed to stopping the judicial filibuster. Now, when the other 70% tunes in, they might be like this, or they might be different. I think the whole question will depend upon how who the public sees as the most reasonable, or the other way, the most unreasonable. Generally, Americans like politicians who compromise, try to get things done, and minimize the fight. So if it should come to the nuclear option, who are they going to blame? The Republican numbers are dropping a little faster than the Democratic numbers, which might argue that the Democrats may have the advantage. But with so many people still out to see on this one, it could go either way.
And you did point out Democratic numbers are not dropping as fast as Republican numbers, but it doesn't seem like anybody's coming out the winner in this.
No, they're not.
Let's get another caller on the line. Drew is with us. Drew's in Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. One of the things I would like to point out is, while many people may think that the filibuster may not be something that should be available in a democracy, we are a republic. And to that end, I think one of the senses that we're seeing more locally may not be the specifics, the interest in the specifics of the issue, but more of an interest and an encouragement that we actually see the Republican Party acting like a party in the majority. For too long, I think there's been a general sense of frustration, especially with the Senate, that they are more interested in their image and maintaining gentlemen's politics than actually going ahead and representing the people or doing the business of the government. We have a couple of visitors from the East, sometimes it feels like, more than representatives in the Senate from Kansas.
So, in other words, you think there's a Republican majority that got elected, they should get ahead with the Republican agenda, majority rule?
I think that if you're going to threaten to filibuster, you should be prepared to stand up and talk for a while, either side. I think that all of us are tired of seeing this nice politics this gentleman's politics, and that if the Republicans are going to have majorities in the House, the Senate, and the administration, they need to start acting like it and using some of that power.
Drew, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Ron Elving, there's a lot of business that needs to get done in the United States Senate. There, or at least a lot of legislators think so. The highway bill, among other things, it's usually wildly popular with everybody.
Well, there are quite a few issues that are hanging fire. We've got an energy package out of the House the Senate hasn't taken up yet. There's going to be a great deal of immigration legislation that's needing to be debated, that's being proposed in both chambers. The Congress would like to get around to talking about taxes yet this year. There is the Social Security proposal from the president. That's making its way through committees and toward the floors. And there are a lot of other things that they would like to get to this year, to put it mildly. That's not going to happen in the Senate in the normal fashion after tomorrow's vote, assuming that we do go to the nuclear option. And this is the reason. In the House, the rules are fairly simple, and there is a majority rule, concept and rule. In the Senate, however, each and every individual member has had a lot of power back through all the history of our republic. And as a result, in the Senate, when you wanted to move forward, you needed to be mindful of the sensitivities of each senator, and you needed to build a consensus that was at least equal to the number of votes necessary to stop a filibuster, if not greater. And as a result, if one party or the other declares war on the filibuster and on the protection of the minority's rights, the other party is likely to withdraw its consent from the usual way of doing things. For example, they always agree not to read a bill, to just go ahead and debate the bill without reading it out loud, which can take hours or days. That could be very easily withheld. And a number of other things can be done to slow down the process in the Senate. Because the Senate has been the place where it was expected that people would compromise, that they would seek the middle, that they would seek consensus. If that's not going to happen, if the Senate's going to be run along the model that the listener just described in urging the Republicans to behave this way, then I think you're going to see the Senate get to be an extraordinarily slow place.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Brad, and Brad's with us from Salt Lake City. Brad, are you there?
How are you, Neil? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Brad, go ahead.
I have two sort of questions. The first one is I don't quite understand the logic behind sort of the Republican thinking. They're saying on the one hand that without question every judicial nominee deserves an up or down vote, and if you don't agree with us on that, then we're going to threaten as a very, very, very last resort to actually make that a rule. I don't understand why they don't just, why it's not just a given that you just make this rule change and move on, why all the dramatics. It's a little like saying, we really want this bill to pass, and if you don't concede to us that it should pass, then we're just going to go ahead and vote on it, darn it. And then the other question that I have is, because I talk to people out here, we kind of have the sense that this is really all about posturing for a potential Supreme Court nominee, and I don't understand why the people looking for a compromise here don't just cut to the chase. Why Harry Reid and some important Democrats don't sit down with Senator Frist and Orrin Hatch and Arlen Specter and somebody from the White House and say, let's just cut right to the chase. Let's scrap these really controversial appellate court nominations. You give us that, and we'll give you Michael McConnell when Chief Justice Rehnquist retires.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron Elving, certainly the Supreme Court, a lot of people saying this is just a skirmish leading up to that battle.
If it were not for the Supreme Court, this probably would have been worked out some months ago. Under previous administrations, previous Senate leadership, this probably would have been worked out months ago. It's entirely possible that some sort of compromise could have been reached. But what a lot of this is about, and by the way, the reason that they don't just make it a rule change is because to formally change the rules in the Senate takes 67 votes, even higher than 60 votes. So that's not going to happen. There isn't the spirit of cooperation to do that. What they would have to do if they were going to work out some sort of a deal on a Supreme Court justice would be to have everybody at the table and say, who could we all agree on? Who could be filibuster-proof as a nominee to the United States Supreme Court? And the administration has said that they don't see it as necessary for them to negotiate with Democrats over their choice of who a Supreme Court nominee would be, any more than they see it as necessary to negotiate over appellate court justices like Priscilla Owen or Janice Rogers Brown. They want to pick the people they want. They want those people to be approved by simple majority. They don't want to negotiate on who they choose for the Supreme Court.
Andy Kohut, you said the polling showed not many people were engaged on this issue. What about on the Supreme Court?
Well, if we get to a Supreme Court appointee, that will bring in the public, particularly if there's a fight which raises the question of moderation. The American public doesn't want the Supreme Court to become more conservative nor more liberal. They want a status quo situation. And if there is an argument about the conservatism of the nominee, it could be quite a problem, particularly because independents these days, our studies show that independents these days are very worried about perhaps the Republican Party going too far in legislating morality and being too conservative. For example, while we found independents breaking about evenly on the argument that President Bush won the election, and if a majority of senators agree, he should get a confirmation. But when it comes to the proposition that the minority party ought to be able to block some judges because they're appointed for life, 2-1, independents say, yes, that's right. They take the Democratic position. So this issue of the direction of the country, moderate, not too conservative, is very important to those people in the middle who are generally the least engaged.
We're talking about the brewing battle over the filibuster and the judicial nominees in the U.S. Senate. Our guests are Andy Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press and NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's a caller, Todd. Todd's with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, you're on the air, Todd. Go ahead.
I love your guests today, and I think they're the perfect candidates to answer one question that I like to ask myself when I listen to your shows: why should I care? I try to keep my ear to the tracks, but generally this kind of stuff is too heady for me, and I don't see where the rubber meets the road. Why should I care?
Ron Elving, why should Todd in Reno, Nevada care?
I can understand why people listen to all this and certainly ask themselves, why should I care? Certainly ask themselves, how does this affect me? It takes a little bit of walking through the consequences through several sequences to see why they should care, unless, of course, they have a particular interest in the federal judiciary or in the interpretation of the law. Most people get interested in those things when an issue comes up that affects them. For example, whether or not they can get an abortion legally in the United States. One of the cases that will come before the next Supreme Court after it's been given a new chief, if we assume that Bill Rehnquist is going to step down, as most people do this summer, one of the issues that will come back before them in all likelihood is the freedom to get an abortion or to get an abortion without certain kinds of parental notification. That case was just added to the Supreme Court docket for next year this morning. So there are issues of that kind. There are issues of economics. There are issues of all kinds of personal freedoms that come before the Supreme Court all the time. A few years ago, the Supreme Court made a ruling regarding homosexual behavior in a Texas case that has changed the landscape of laws regarding gay life in America, gay people in America, let the door open to the issue of gay marriage, which is probably going to come before the Supreme Court in and of itself. And these things are going to be decided by the very people whose identity is being determined by this argument. This is a big argument over process and procedure, but it all has to do with picking people who will make decisions that will affect the everyday lives of average Americans.
Yeah, and if I could just weigh in, I think that last thing that you said, Ron, is really important. When ordinary people hear this, they hear an argument about process, because the reporting is about what's going on up on the Hill. It's very much inside baseball. But there are all of these connecting links that are quite important to people, but that isn't registering. So that's why we're only getting about a third in these polls saying, yeah, I'm really tracking the ins and outs of this. But a much broader percentage of people would be engaged if they saw those connections.
Hmm. And I think we'll get there very soon.
And we're going to have some serious drama later today when this debate goes on all night, and then then we could come up with a vote as soon as tomorrow. Ron Elving. First of all, Todd, thanks for the call.
That was
Thank you. Exactly the right question to ask. Ron Elving, thanks very much for being with us. Ron Elving is NPR Senior Washington Editor. Andy Kohut, as always, we appreciate your time today.
Happy to be here.
Andy Kohut is Director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. When we come back from a short break, legendary comics creator Will Eisner's last book, Taking on a Global Lie. If you have questions about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.